One of the reasons we know the church isn't going anywhere is because it's built on the unshakable foundation of the permanence and the righteousness of God.
Welcome to Light the Way, featuring the verse-by-verse Bible teaching of Dr. Colin Monger, Senior Pastor at Shepherd of the Hills Church. Jesus said, "You're the light of the world," and that's what we want to help you be. And one way you can shine your light is by supporting this program. Become a Light Partner, and with your monthly support, you'll be helping us reach the world with the gospel. In addition to reaching others, new Light Partners receive a free copy of Dr. Monger's book, Meet Jesus, looking at the seven signs and I Am statements in the Gospel of John. If you'd like more information about the ministry or to become a Light Partner, log on to www.lighttheway.radio.org. But right now, join us as we open our Bibles and begin.
So if you'd open your Bibles there, we're in Revelation chapter 3. Back in 2017, Yale University created a brand new class in their psychological department. It was called Psychology and the Good Life. And according to the university, it was the most popular class in the history of the college because more than 25% of the entire undergraduate class all signed up. And it's probably because most people want to succeed in life, don't they? You know, I've never met a person who said, I just want to fail at everything. But I have met lots of people who are trying to be better, whether it's at their job or in a marriage or a relationship or in their family or they want a better reputation. People want to succeed in life. It would also appear that for everyone, that definition, success, looks a little bit different. For example, one person may say you're successful if you have a lot of money. The more money in your bank account, the more successful you are. Others may say the one with the happiest family, the one with the happiest marriage, the one who gets the biggest promotion at work. I saw a sign one day that said, "He who dies with the most tools wins." For some, that may be the definition of success, but it is different for every person. And for every one of these definitions, if you go online, there are a list of people trying to tell you how to get it. I went online and I looked it up. There are hundreds of millions of hits when you type in succeeding in life. One of those lists put it this way: identify your passions, list your goals and how to achieve them, live purposefully, and finally, stick to your commitments. Another list had these: take action, be authentic, improve social skills, learn to delay gratification, and have the perseverance for long-time goals. Each one of those lists differs in some way, in many ways, but they all seem to have one thing in common. It's the idea of perseverance, of endurance. You see, success doesn't just happen overnight. It takes work. It takes determination, even when the odds seem stacked against you. No successful person will ever tell you it was always easy, but they will say they had to keep going. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. You know the sayings. Succeeding in life takes determination. That's also, by the way, how a church succeeds in ministry. And it's something we see the church at Philadelphia in our Bible verse this morning doing very well. They've persevered. They've kept going, even in the face of challenge. Even in the face of obstacles, they have kept going. They've stayed faithful. And that's really what this letter is all about. This letter is one of praise to this church. And honestly, if you ask me, it's a nice change of pace. Because all of these letters have been very negative, haven't they? I mean, most of them have been reprimands to failing churches. For example, the very first letter, the letter to the church at Ephesus, says, "You have some good works, church. I know what you've done." He said, "But you've lost your love. You've forgotten why you're even here." When you come to the church at Sardis, Jesus doesn't have a single positive thing to say to the entire congregation. A lot of negative going on in those letters. But then we come to this church in Philadelphia. And as I said, it's a change of pace. Everything is praise. Everything is positive. There's not one negative thing to say in the whole letter. And that's because this is a good church. Now, it's not a perfect church. But it is a good church, and it's important that we make that distinction because it's easy to look at success and forget that even the most successful organizations are still imperfect. Even the most successful ministries are still imperfect. It's easy to see success and forget that, but it's important to remember. And that's because look at us. Just look around the room. We're a motley crew, aren't we? Every one of us has shortcomings. Every one of us has faults. We all make mistakes. Listen to what Jesus said in Luke 5. I've not come to call the righteous, people who are righteous in their own mind. He said, but I came to call sinners to repentance. He said in Luke 19, for the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. Now, when you take a bunch of sinners and lost people and put them all together, you're going to have imperfection. And so the church at Philadelphia, as we read this, keep in mind, they're not perfect, but they are good. And so there's a lot we can learn from this church and from this letter. And so we look at it. It starts in Revelation 3, verse 7. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, the words of the Holy One, the true One, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one opens. I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door, which no one is able to shut. I know that you have but little power, and yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. Behold, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Jews and are not, but lie. Behold, I will make them come and bow down at your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. Because you have kept my word about patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world to try those who dwell on the earth. I'm coming soon. Hold fast what you have so that no one may seize your crown. The one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it, and I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down from my God out of heaven, and my own new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. You know, if somebody wanted to start a new business, one of the first things they would do is research other similar businesses that have succeeded. And they'd look at those and they'd learn from success and failure and they'd figure out what they can apply to their own situation. Well, if a person was starting a new church today, if you were going out and planting a new congregation in an area there'd never been a church and you needed some instruction, this would be a great one to look at. This letter would be great to study because there are so many lessons to be learned from church ministry right here. And there's a lot that we can learn this morning. And the very first thing I want you to notice is that when God opens a door, nothing can stop you. Notice what it says in verse 8. Behold, I have set before you an open door, which no one is able to shut. You know, one of our places that we go in the summer for vacation or just a day away is the beach or the shore, as people call it around here. And usually we go to Ocean City, New Jersey. We like it there. There's not any alcohol. The beaches are clean. There's not fights. Traffic isn't terrible, at least typically when we go. And it's just a nice place to go for our family. But you know, right before we get into New Jersey, we have to go through our own city of Philadelphia. And it's the last stop, if you really think about it, before we cross the state line, because then we get on the bridge, go over the river, and halfway across, it's welcome to New Jersey. And we're now on the eastern seaboard of the United States. Well, the Church of Philadelphia, from our letter here, is very similar. Geographically speaking, it was 60 miles east of Jerusalem. It was actually almost all destroyed in the same earthquake of 17 AD that affected some of the other churches in the area and affected that region, but it really took down this city in a lot of ways. But that's where it was. And it was the last city a person would go through before heading into Asia. And because of that reason, it was a cultural hub. Kind of like an airport, if you think about it. A building, a single location filled with people coming and going. All different cultures and all different languages and all converging into that one location before going their separate ways. That's Philadelphia. It's a hub. filled with travelers and merchants and hotels and inns and places you can pick up supplies. It is a buffet of world culture, which, as you might imagine, is a great place to put a church, because you could reach people in a way that will literally spread to the entire world, and in ways and through ways you might not ever otherwise be able to do. And that's where the church is, right in the middle of the action. And here's our takeaway from that. Throughout your life, God will put you into positions of opportunity. He will put you into places and at times where he opens a door of ministry that you might not have ever seen in a different time or a different place. He'll open those doors. There was a Sunday school teacher who was teaching her class of children, and she said, "Well, did you know, kids, God is with you everywhere you go, even if you can't see him?" And one energetic little four-year-old stood up and said, "Teacher, I know he is. Because every time we get to the store, he opens the door up before we walk into the window." I don't know if that's the door it's talking about. But God does open doors. He'll open opportunities for ministry. He'll provide you opportunities to serve and to give and to pray and to be there for somebody in a way you might not ever have seen. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 16, "A wide door for effective work has opened to me." He said in Colossians 4, "Pray for us that God may open a door to the world for us to declare the mystery of Christ." And so it says here in verse 8, "Behold, I have set before you an open door." They have a chance to minister to people. Unlike any of the other churches, that door has been flung wide open. But there's something else to notice about that statement. Notice it says, "I have set before you an open door." It doesn't say, "I have opened all the doors," but "I have set before you an open door," a singular one. There is an opportunity. Some of the doors have been opened, but not all of them. And here's why that's important. Just because someone else is called to something doesn't mean we are. Just because we're called to something doesn't mean someone else is. Not all things are for all people. God is guiding you in life. He has a path for your life. Jeremiah 29 says, "I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord." There is a plan for each person's life. And that plan involves certain things, and it doesn't involve certain things. And that even happened to Paul. It says in Acts chapter 16, when they, that is Paul and Silas and Timothy, they were going around, they were ministering to people, they were preaching the gospel. It says, when they went through the region of Phrygia and Galatia, having been forbidden by the Holy Spirit to go into Asia. It was a door that was closed. It goes on to say, they attempted to go into Bithynia, but the Spirit of Jesus would not allow them. Yet another door that was closed. And yet God opened other doors for Paul to walk through with no problem. That's an important thing to remember. Because often when we're going through life and we're going through this journey of faith, God will have a plan for us. But you know, in our peripheral, we'll see something shiny. Something that looks good. It looks like a good thing to do. And nobody would say it's not a good thing to do. And yet it would take us off the path that God would have. God's plan for your life includes certain things. And you will frustrate yourself more than any other thing. And you will do it in more successful a way than any other way, by forcing yourself to focus on doors God has closed. You will frustrate yourself more by trying to force those open than almost anything else. Listen to what Helen Keller said. "When one door of happiness closes, another opens. But often we look so long at the closed door that we do not see the one which has been opened for us." Spending a whole life in front of a door God has deadbolted and not seeing the one right next to it which has been opened up wide. God doesn't open all the doors. He opens some of the doors. And so it says here, "Behold, I have before you an open door." Now that does a couple things for us, or at least it should. First of all, it provides you a sense of relief, doesn't it? Because it means I don't have to do everything. I don't have to be good at everything. I don't have to be involved in everything. All I have to worry about is walking through the doors God has already opened. I don't have to worry about the ones he hasn't. Only the ones he has. Listen to what it says in Ephesians 4. He gave some to be apostles, prophets, evangelists, shepherds, and teachers. Everybody has a job, but not one person does all the jobs. It's okay to not be good at everything. It's okay to have a weakness. Do you have some things you can think about in life that you're just not very good at, no matter how hard you try? I'll tell you what, I will never be a pro football player. It's not my strength. I'm sorry, I just don't find that interesting. I'm not good at those things. But that's okay, because God hasn't opened those doors. That's not my job. So it provides us a sense of relief. Imagine how stressful it would be if the Bible said, I've opened all the doors and you have to fill every need you ever find. We'd go crazy trying to do that. And so it says, I have set before you an open door. There's an opportunity for you to fill, a very specific thing. Second, it provides reassurance. So it's a sense of relief and it provides reassurance. Because while God may not open every door, the ones he does cannot be closed by any person, any group, any government, any enemy, any detractor, it says in verse 8 here, which no one is able to shut. And here's what that means for us. Don't be afraid of the giants in the land. I say this all the time. Do not fear the giants in the land. Don't be afraid of challenge when it's something God's called you to do. Don't be afraid of what seems like impossibility if God has called you to do it. You remember the story of Israel going into the land of Canaan and how they came to the border and they sent 12 spies in, and the 12 spies came back and 10 of them convinced the whole congregation, 2 million people, it couldn't be done. There's giants in that land, they said. They have an army in that land. They have defenses in that land. There's no way we'll beat them. We're slaves. They're professional soldiers. It can't be done. And before long, the whole people was so afraid, it kept them from the blessing God said was already theirs. Don't fear the giants in the land. If you need money to do something God has called you to do, you might not have it now, but you will. If you need space, God will give you the space. If you need the time in your schedule, God will provide you the time. It says in Psalm chapter 50, every beast of the field is mine, and the cattle on 1,000 hills. And Jesus said in Matthew 6, your Father knows what you need even before you ask. So don't fear the giants in the land, because when God opens a door, nothing can stop you. The second thing we learn from this letter is worldly limits don't limit our God. Notice what it goes on to say here in verse 8. I know that you have but little power. This is a small church, the church at Philadelphia. This is a tiny group of believers. And so he says, I know you have but little power. You are a little church. You are limited in almost every way we can imagine. You know, isn't it amazing how as people we tend to decide what God can do based on what we think is possible? Even though we read in the Bible over and over and over again all of these miracles, how he parted a sea so Israel could escape, how he rose from the grave just to bring us life, how over and over again God defied natural law, and yet we still bring ourselves to say things like, it can't be done. It's too hard. It's going to cost too much money. I don't have the resources. I don't have the skill. That's impossible. Worldly limits do not limit God. This is a church of great limitation. You might call it that, the Church of Philadelphia. We often think of the city of brotherly love. You could call this the church of great limitation because they had almost nothing. And yet God did incredible things. You know, back in 1961, the Soviet Union detonated something called the Tsar Bomba. Some of you may remember that event. You might have read about it. Maybe you've never heard of it. But it remains to be, even to this day, the most powerful nuclear explosion in the history of the world. It was a 50-megaton bomb. Nothing like it has ever been detonated since or before. The mushroom cloud alone went 40 miles into the sky and was 59 miles across at the widest point. It was so hot that if you were to have been 60 miles away from the blast, you would have still received third-degree burns. The blast was so powerful that it blasted windows from homes 560 miles away. It was detonated 4 miles above Earth, but it was such a big explosion, it created a 5.5 magnitude earthquake, and the shock wave could be registered even on its third trip around the planet. The biggest thing to ever explode in the history of the world, coming from something physically the size of a car. God can do anything through even the smallest person, even the smallest church. And as powerful as that bomb was, your faith is even more powerful. Jesus said in Matthew 17, if you had the faith of a mustard seed, you could move a mountain. It's amazing what God can do through the lives of people who are willing to follow his lead. And that is this church at Philadelphia. This is a church that has very little. They're very small, but they have a big God, and they have faith. Out of all the churches, it's probably the smallest. This church at Philadelphia doesn't have the ministries of Ephesus. They don't have the ongoings. They don't have the busyness. They don't have the works of Ephesus. They don't have the population or even the membership of Pergamum. Sardis had a better reputation in the community. And yet when it comes to this little church, by all measure, we would consider it to be a struggling church, hoping to keep the doors open one more week. It's very likely the pastor couldn't draw a salary, had to work a separate job. It's likely they didn't even have their own building. They probably shared it with some other group or met in somebody's house. They struggled. And so Jesus said, I know you have but little power. There's only a little bit you can do, which is what makes this even more interesting, because that's why God chose them to begin with. They're a little church, and yet God does great things. You see, God chooses people he can shine through. And pride in a heart is a lot like drapes on a window. It doesn't let any of the light through. In 1 Corinthians 1, it says, consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were noble. Not many were of good reputation, he says. But God chose that which is foolish in the world to shame the wise. He chose what's weak to shame the strong. And yet in our world, we assume that if we succeed, it's because we're the strongest. It's because we're the smartest. It's because we're the fastest or the best. If we get the job, it must be because we were the top applicant. And yet in the economy of God's kingdom, things are completely reversed. In Matthew chapter 20, Jesus said, the last will be first, and the first will be last. You remember the story of God calling Moses at the burning bush? I've always enjoyed that. Because he calls Moses and he says, I want you to go speak against Pharaoh. And I've always liked that story for a number of reasons, one of which is God waited until Moses was 80 years old and a shepherd in the field to call him to go do this thing. He didn't call Moses when he was a prince of Egypt, did he? He didn't call Moses when he had money and an army and respect and royal resources, when he could have commanded this thing to happen and nobody would have flinched. He didn't call Moses then. He waited until he was sleeping in a field with sheep. He waited until he'd lost everything. He waited until he had become very small and humbled. And then he said, Moses, I want you to do something you're not even good at. And we know that because Moses comes back to God and said, I am not eloquent of speech. I'm slow of tongue, he says. I'm not a speaker, Lord. You want me to challenge the Pharaoh of the mightiest kingdom on earth? I can't even get a sentence out in one try. And none of that has changed, he said. Not since you've talked to me or before, I still can't speak. And God said in the next verse, who made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what to say. In other words, Moses, I know you're not a speaker. I know you're not smooth of tongue, and I know you're not fluid of speech. I know this is not in your wheelhouse, which is why I'm calling you, because you can't do it. And that way, when people hear you talking, they'll think it's a miracle. That's exactly why Moses was called. And that's why this church at Philadelphia is so worthy of note. They are the smallest church. They have the least amount of resources, the least amount of skill. And yet Jesus praises them more than all the other churches combined. Maybe right now you're facing something and you don't know how it's going to work out. Maybe the numbers don't add up. Maybe you've tried everything you know and nothing has solved the problem. Maybe you're at the end of your rope. Well, let me remind you that our God is not limited by the limits of the world. Worldly limits do not limit God. And the third thing we're going to take away from this letter as we close. Size does not determine success. Notice what it says in verse 10. Remember, it's a small church, but he says, because you have kept my word about patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial. You have kept my word. You've stayed faithful. That's winning. That's success. And it's the smallest church that Jesus gives that praise. Many of you have probably never heard the name Muggsy Bogues. If you're a sports enthusiast, you probably have. If you're not, it's a new name. Muggsy Bogues was a professional basketball player for the Charlotte Hornets during the 90s or so. And I really enjoyed watching Muggsy Bogues play because his career lasted 14 years, a decade and a half just about, which is astonishing because the average NBA career is only 5 years. He played 3 times longer than the average player. Over that career, he scored 6,858 points. He had a very respectable career. He's in the NBA Hall of Fame. And Muggsy Bogues was 5'3" tall. 4 inches shorter, and he could have qualified for disability. But nobody ever told him that. Size does not determine success. And that's something else that's very different in our world today, isn't it? Because people assume size and success go together. People assume that if you have more money, you're doing better. If you have a bigger house, you're doing better. Bigger is better. More is better. We live in a society of more and more and more. And it even happens in churches. People think the church with 100 people is better than a church of 10. If you've got 10,000 people in your church, you must be doing it right. And yet, if you read through the Bible, you will find that a numeric basis for success is one of the most unscriptural ways to determine it. Nowhere in the Bible, nowhere in the New Testament does it say, he with the most people in his congregation is doing the best. It doesn't tell us that. About a year and a half ago, you might not have even noticed it, but in our bulletin, we took out the attendance. We stopped counting. I have no idea how many people precisely attend this church in a week, and it doesn't matter. Because it doesn't matter if it's 10 or 1,000. It does not determine success. Success in your faith is not determined by width. It's always determined by depth. It's measured by faithfulness and endurance. And what have you done with the door God has opened for you? Deuteronomy 7 says, it was not because you were more in number that the Lord chose you, talking about Israel. It goes on to say, for you were the fewest of all the people, and yet that nation conquered the land of Canaan. And that nation resisted invasion from foreign nations even as recently as 1970 and continues to resist the pressure of a lot of the international community. Not only that, that nation produced Jesus Christ, and all from a country that was the fewest of all the people. But notice how Jesus closes in verse 11. He says, I am coming soon. Hold fast what you have so that no one may seize your crown. Success in ministry is not defined by how much you have, but rather what have you done with it? Ministry is not about quantity. It's always about quality. It's not about numbers. It's about faithfulness. And a successful Christian understands that. So what about you? What about your personal ministry? You know, the one God has called you to, whether it be sharing with a neighbor, leading your family, being a voice in the community, doing something in your church, whatever it may be God has called you to do. How are you doing with that door? If Jesus were writing a letter today and it had your name on it, what would it say?